From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The Department of Environmental Quality reorganizes. We talk with the director.
Are there places for us to grow and be more successful in our work with the citizens of Michigan? Absolutely.
This is the anniversary of the Oklahoma City bombing. We'll tell you about the Michigan connections.
They were building and testing bombs at the farm.
A released juvenile lifer advocates for more to be released.
As adults now, we understand harm that we've committed. But during the time as a young child, I think that punishment has been served.
Why the salaries of Supreme Court justices have been frozen since 2002.
We've turned executive pay into a political problem.
And we hear from the latest artisan of Michigan.
So I started off with dyeing, and then that quickly moved to weaving and spinning and felting, and everything together and combining them is what I love to do most.
Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Things are changing at Michigan's Department of Environmental Quality. It's unveiling a new logo because the agency is reorganizing and its name is changing starting next week. It will be called the Michigan Department of Environment, Great Lakes, and Energy, and folks are already shortening that to EGLE, pronounced Eagle. Joining us now is the department's director, Liesl Clark. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Lester. I'm happy to be here.
So making changes on Earth Day, huh?
Yeah, so that was circumstantial, but how poetic.
I guess so. Well, let's talk about some of the changes. There are several taking place. First of all, you're creating an Office of Climate and Energy. What is that?
Yeah, that's right. So with the reorganization in the executive order, there were a few things that were laid out in front of us. In addition to the Office of Climate and Energy, also creating an Office of Environmental Justice Public Advocate, an Office of the Clean Water Public Advocate. So we're really excited about these new roles. The governor, when she signed the executive order for the reorganization of EAGLE, she also signed an executive directive that joins Michigan to the U.S. Climate Alliance. So this is reinforcing the position that Michigan is in. Michigan is part of the climate discussion. So we will be working on staffing that office up and starting really from a beginning point of doing inventory work. So looking forward to making progress in that world.
So let's talk about some of those other offices that that you're going to be establishing. You're moving the Office of the Great Lakes from the DNR to EAGLE. Why?
So the Office of the Great Lakes actually just moved to DNR. It's not even been there a whole year. When the governor looked at the structure for state government, one of the things that she was really passionate about from an environmental perspective was that the Great Lakes are a common denominator for everything that we do in this state. Because they are that common denominator, she thought it was really important to elevate how we view the role of the Great Lakes in the regulatory structure. And so it was really important to make that part of the department again, and then also to elevate it. And that's why you see, you know, Environment, Great Lakes, and Energy. At the same time, one of the things that I'm truly focused on, as well as my other cabinet members, is making sure that we continue to have really firm cohesion between the departments on policy issues. So, of course, there's a lot of Great Lakes issues that I share with my colleagues at Department of Agriculture and Rural Development, as well as Department of Natural Resources.
Let's talk about those two kind of ombudsman offices you were talking about. Office of Clean Water Public Advocate. What will that office do?
So that office is another opportunity for raising issues from a water perspective. So the idea is that there are a variety of ways to communicate with the department right now, from the traditional to the non-traditional. But adding one more person who can be a resource to help answer questions from within the regulatory structure, but then also somebody who's out there on the front lines, who's visible, who is in communities, and who can easily be tapped as a resource to get questions answered.
So I'm guessing this is in case you have a situation like Flint where the people are complaining because the water is yellow and there's something wrong with it, they actually have somebody they can go directly to and say, hey, there's a problem.
Yeah, you know, Governor Whitmer is really committed to making sure that we've got the best quality drinking water we can have across the state. And so this is another way to make sure that we have a reinforced mechanism to implement that policy goal.
I want to ask, in this office, could people also ask about or tell that office about pollution problems that they're aware of?
Yeah, I mean, we'd be happy to you know, try to figure out the best way to get that information in whatever way. We also have a pollution hotline, the PEAS hotline. So there's a few different avenues to get into the department, and we'd be happy to take communication whatever way people are comfortable.
Okay, the Environmental Justice Public Advocate. Explain that, what that is.
So, you know, environmental justice is something that has been worked on through previous administrations in the state. Governor Whitmer felt really, again, really strongly that this needed to be something from the outset. And it's something that is, again, someone on the front lines, somebody in communities who is, in some respects, the face of the department, partnering, of course, with the district offices who are absolutely on the front lines and the face of the department as well. But giving them and community members another place to go to have conversations, to support public hearings, to create another avenue for public dialogue so that there's an opportunity to have a back and forth. You know, we feel really strongly that, you know, environmental justice is a really critical issue, you know, in the 48217 zip code, but also across the state. All 83 counties have, you know, people that we could be communicating with better. And one of the themes from my perspective is, you know, certainly building on the foundation of the department, but, you know, encouraging all of us to look at these types of communication methods and figuring out how to do them better, how to be better at it.
You mentioned that zip code. Let's hone in on that, because not everybody knows that zip code. So why is that zip code an important place to talk about when you're dealing with environmental justice?
Well, 48217 represents the zip code in southwest Detroit that has had some of the largest challenges when it comes to contamination pollution issues. And so that's one that, you know, certainly stands out as a place where, you know, we certainly have already spent a lot of time and a lot of attention, but, you know, we'll continue to do so going forward.
The reputation of the department took a big hit during the Flint water crisis. And it's also been accused of being too cozy with some of the state's big polluters, and including at least one in that zip code you talk about. How do you overcome that? How do you change the corporate culture within an agency to get past that?
So, you know, there's a lot of cultural conversations that are necessary across state government. And I'll tell you, and certainly at the department as well, I'll, you know, share with you a little bit of what I spoke with my entire team about on Wednesday when we did unveil the new logo. Name changes, logos, you know, they're not important. What is important is the work of this department. What is important is our people and the difference that we make every day in the lives of the citizens of Michigan. It's why we get out of bed and choose to work together. What we need to do is we need to do a better job of telling that story externally, and we need to do a better job of communicating with each other internally. Are there places for us to grow and be more successful in our work with the citizens of Michigan? Absolutely. 100%. But I got to say, you know, I'm proud of the work of the people in this department, and I'm proud to be one of them.
One of the issues that popped up during Flint was the lack of transparency and the lack of a good lead to the governor himself at that time. How can you get past that? I mean, if it's in the culture to hide things, that's not good for the agency or the state.
Yeah, so, you know, I wasn't here. I haven't been here for the last 5 years. I don't think that me armchair quarterbacking the last 5 years is very productive. What I would like to focus on is what we need to do going forward. And I know that, you know, the governor's been very committed to this issue of transparency. You know, you look at her initial executive orders right out of the gate, and, you know, it reinforces how she intends to run this administration. And I, of course, 100% intend to follow in that approach. So there are always ways to get better, and there are always communication disconnects to break down. Can I guarantee that we won't ever have big challenges? Absolutely not. You know, in some respects, our job as the department is to go find the problems. That's what we're here for. In fact, you know, changes to the lead and copper rule from 2018 under the previous administration are going to encourage more intense study over the next few months, and making sure that we're on the front line and figuring out, you know, what do we see when we get results back from that more intense study. It's really is important. That's our job. We're here to find the problems, and I want to encourage people to find the problems.
I don't want to keep dwelling on this, but I want to ask you about the state's big polluters and the agency being too cozy, as has been alleged. We're talking about a refinery and steel mills and Wolverine with the PFAS mess. Has that been a real issue or is that just a perception?
So I think it's important to understand what the role of the department is. The department's role is to implement statute from a regulatory perspective. So, you know, our job is, you know, when people come with a permit to do what they want to do, our job is to work within the statute in order to understand if they can be permitted to do what they want to do. I also think it's important to define who are our stakeholders. You know, I look at our stakeholders as being fundamentally the citizens of the state of Michigan that reinforces our work to protect public health and the environment. The stakeholders are also a pretty broad group of community groups, also, you know, non-governmental agencies, you know, groups like the Association of County Drain Commissioners, MTA, the Michigan Township Association, Michigan Counties Association. You know, there's a variety of entities that are stakeholders, and the business community are our stakeholders too. We get pulled in a lot of different directions, and I think that it's important to make sure that we are appropriately giving value to those different directions and then acting as is set forth for us within the parameters of statute.
On a lighter note, what are your plans for Earth Day?
Oh, I'm really excited about Earth Day. So on Monday, Earth Day itself, I'm actually spending time, I've been working really hard to have a chance to meet all 1,100 employees in the department, and I am going to be with our office in Warren, which I'm really looking forward to. And then on Wednesday, the quality of life departments, as we call them with shorthand, so it's Ag, Natural Resources, and the New Eagle, we do a shared Earth Day event, and it's been over a decade that this event's been going on. We bring in thousands of school kids to Constitution Hall. Stop by if you're around. So we have thousands of special guests and a variety of different booths and things that the kids can learn about when they're here. And on top of that, we're going to have hopefully a couple of extra special guests from the Capitol, as well as some of our legislative friends over here to join us. So I'm really looking forward to that.
Liesl Clark is the director of what will be known as the Michigan Department of Environment, Great Lakes, and Energy. You can call it Eagle. Thanks very much for taking the time.
No problem, Lester. Glad to do it.
Up next, after 30 years in Michigan prisons, Antonio Espri was released. Then he enrolled in college.
The students, they're shocked to be able to be in the company of someone who doesn't fit a particular stigma of what a prisoner looks like.
Life after a life sentence. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Back in 2017, we talked with Antonio Espri. He was one of the Michigan juvenile lifers who was released after the Supreme Court ruled that mandatory life without parole sentences for teens under 18 were unconstitutional. We thought we'd check back with Antonio Espri. Welcome back to Stateside.
Well, thank you for having me.
Last time we talked, you enrolled in classes at Arizona State University in the fall of 17. How's that going?
So classes at the University of Arizona is most definitely going good for me. My major is Justice Studies. I'm in the School of Social Transformation. It's my second year. I'm in person now. The first time I was online student.
Right.
So having in-person classes allows me the opportunity to sit in a classroom and listen to a professor lecture. Not being able to be in a classroom in decades, you know, the feeling is good. Having peers that's young enough to be my children and grandchildren is also kind of hilarious. But I'm enjoying the environment and everything that's being offered.
We've talked about this a little bit in the past when you were on the program, but you served 30 years in prison. What's the adjustment been like for you?
So the adjustment, returning back to society, is a continual and will be continual adjusting period. It has been more positive because of what I have adjusted my time and my life to and towards, which is school and work and being involved in community events. And so it allows me to interact and it allows me to get involved in things that I have a strong passion for. So the adjustment has been very, very positive, but it's a continual adjustment.
What about, you know, outside of the classroom, outside of events, what's life like?
Life is wonderful. Life is beautiful. I am able to offer my experiences to help people better understand the issues around juveniles who have experienced the incarceration experience, juveniles who are getting out of prisons and returning back to communities.
You're talking to your professors about this, your classmates?
I'm talking to my professors about this. I'm talking to certain classmates about this who...
What's their reaction?
Their reaction from the professors, they're very proud and very welcoming of me to be at the university and be in their classroom. As far as the students, they're shocked to be able to be in the company of someone who doesn't fit a particular stigma of what a prisoner looks like or what a prisoner sounds like. So that stigma, but they're shocked and at the same time, they're taken back and, you know, they welcome it. So the assistance that's given to me by, you know, both the students and the professors are pretty much a warm and welcoming, you know, back to our society, back in community, back to school. And they're proud of me, you know, proud of the fact that I'm at the age that I am, taking education seriously, trying to do something with my life, not giving up or, you know, making excuses for anything.
We also want to ring in Deb LaBelle, who's been keeping us informed about juvenile lifers in Michigan. LaBelle is director of the Juvenile Life Without Parole Initiative at Michigan American Civil Liberties Union. So could you give us a brief reminder why the Supreme Court ruled life without parole for juveniles was basically unconstitutional?
Sure. It's now been since 2012. The U.S. Supreme Court recognized that children, when they commit offenses, even harsh offenses, including murder, that they're still children and that their environment and their capacity, their unique capacity for growth and learning provides a requirement that they have to have an opportunity to be their rehabilitation be recognized and come back into our community.
Sure, their brain's still developing at that age, right?
And so to do anything else, the court said is cruel and unusual punishment and fails to recognize, as you say, that they're still developing, that they're in households, that they lack choices, and that when you're under 18 in the civil society, you have very limited rights. And so you can't then say, oh, we're going to treat you the same as if you're an adult in the criminal system.
Now, Michigan had more than 360 juvenile lifers. That's the second most in the state. I think Pennsylvania had more. Is that right?
Originally, yes.
How many have yet to have their sentences reconsidered?
Over 200.
Really?
We're still waiting.
Why aren't things moving faster? I mean, this has been a couple, 3 years now.
It has been. We have a couple of counties that have been really resistant to recognizing what the Supreme Court says. You get an opportunity for resentencing. We had a prior attorney general who was antagonistic to the whole concept that children are different and have an opportunity to...
Right. Bill Schuette fought it in the courts. Yeah, yeah.
Fought it every inch of the way. And so what we have is we have a few counties in which the prosecutors have decided that instead of listening to the Supreme Court that said it's only the very rare juvenile, very, very rare, I think Justice Sotomayor said in the most recent decision, that would be incapable of rehabilitation and should perhaps the sentence of life without parole might be appropriate. Instead, in Oakland County, for example, the prosecutor there sought life without parole again for almost every single juvenile in that county. And that's what's happened. And then requested a stay for a while they got ready for this. And so those have been going very, very slowly, as in the counties that have sought for all of their youth that they again have life without parole. People have not had the opportunity, despite sitting for years, the sentences have been vacated, and they're sitting there without the opportunity to demonstrate. But I will say, coming off of yesterday, just a client of ours who was the prosecutor sought life without parole in Oakland County, and when the judges hear that someone has served 29 years and has 12 misconduct tickets, when the people who were in there, the former officers, come forward and say, this is an amazing person who he has become, when every testimony is rehabilitation, the judge essentially gave that man time served yesterday. So when you can get to the judges, past the prosecutors, and actually present the deep rehabilitation stories that are there, you know, people are getting a term of years. And the parole board is recognizing there are no risks. We have 91 people out.
As you mentioned, we have a different attorney general. Dana Nessel's in office now. Has there been anything different from the AG's office in regards to juvenile lifers? Or is it out of her hands at this point?
Well, I think she sets a tone, a very different tone than Bill Schuette set. I think that she has made statements that she's going to represent all people and that, you know, recognizes the decency and basic entitlement of rights for everyone in this state. And I think she evidenced that when she came in the ACLU, we had a class action, the Hill case, that actually went up and down through the federal courts, and the courts awarded everyone in the juvenile lifers their good time and disciplinary credits, which has opened up people's ability to get off much earlier seeing the parole board. And when she came in, Bill Schuette was trying to take that up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and she stopped that, recognizing that the Supreme Court's decisions, both the Michigan court decisions and the federal court decisions, were correct. So I think she set the tone there.
Is there anything concrete she can do beyond what you're just talking about there?
As head prosecutor of the state, she can continue to set the tone that prosecutors should look carefully at each case and not just assume that everyone should serve life without parole, and make some careful decisions about what they're going forward with. I mean, these trials are costly, not just emotionally, to individuals who thought, I was going to have a chance, and now they're still trying to impose life without parole, but also in terms of the cost to the state and the counties as to try these cases.
Antonio, I have to ask you a hard question, because I really want to get to this. How does that crime that you committed when you were 16 weigh on you now that you're in your 40s and trying to put your life together?
So the crime that I committed at 16, I had no way of understanding at that age the ramifications of all what was involved, all who was harmed as far as family, community, the harm that I projected upon myself. I had no way of understanding that and what that meant. And as we look at the age that I am now, the development in terms of my maturity, the opportunity to be able to reflect upon life more responsible in a different frame of mind, different values, different morals, different experiences, I understand and can be responsible and accountable for my actions as an adult now. That's the difference. So there's no weight in terms of in now, because not only have I been forgiven for what I'd done as a young boy by both my victim's mother and victim's daughter, but I've also been forgiven by society. And so, you know, one of the things is that what should be done now today under this administration versus what was done under the prior Snyder administration is that the citizens of the state of Michigan no longer is led by fear. And the citizens want to see juveniles released. The citizens of the state of Michigan want to have juveniles who've done 25, 30, 35 years and more released back into society and back into community, because it's people like me and other juveniles who are shown as examples that we are out here in our communities and back out here connected to our society to do that which is right. And we have not at one time presented ourselves in a harmful or conflicting way. So it goes against the ideologies about fear, about releasing juveniles and what that looks like. And so it's time to embrace what citizens truly want. You know, we understand the harm as adults now. We understand the harm that we've committed. But during the time as a young child, I think that punishment has been served. You know, I've said it before, Michigan does not do adults who've committed the same type of crimes like they do juveniles. And the fact that adults can plea bargain out because they have an understanding and a mentality that's mature enough to give them that way out, and juveniles who are young do not understand what it is about taking pleas. I think that, you know, that type of leverage that's used in adults versus what's not given in consideration to our young kids, our juveniles, I think it is unfair.
Antonio Espri was sentenced to life without parole as a juvenile until the Supreme Court ruled that that was unconstitutional. He's now out of prison and going to college. Deb LaBelle is the director of Juvenile Life Without Parole Initiative at Michigan American Civil Liberties Union. Thanks to both of you for coming in and sharing.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
We reached out to the Attorney General's office for comment, but we've not heard back. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. We go out and visit with the craftspeople who make the things we use on occasion. We call the series Artisans of Michigan, and this week our artisan is in Grand Rapids.
I'm Megan Williams, and my company is Adventure Textiles.
Megan Williams is a member of a vibrant community of Grand Rapids people making all kinds of things. Williams works in textiles.
Textiles to me is anything with fabric, and I name my company Adventure Textiles because it's whatever I'm experimenting with in textiles. There's so many things to experiment within the textile category. So I started off with dyeing, and then that quickly moved to weaving and spinning and felting, and everything together and combining them is what I love to do most.
The first time I became aware of your work, it was because I saw some cowls, and I was told that you had woven some of the cowls fabric, and I thought that was really special. Why weave it when you can buy it pretty cheaply?
When I was getting into textiles, I started crocheting, and as I was crocheting, I realized how long it took. I crocheted a blanket, and then it took 100 hours or more, and I thought there's no way that I could sell this. So I started looking for quicker ways to do it. And funny enough, weaving is actually pretty quick. As soon as you get the loom all set up, you're just weaving back and forth, and it weaves up pretty nicely. So that's the textile art that I started with.
How do you describe your work to somebody? If you had to tell them on the phone or on the radio, as this is, what does your work look like?
So my primary work is cowls, or what I call cowls. So they're shorter scarves that are connected with like little leather snaps, brass and leather snaps. So they're, once again, shorter rectangles or squares or triangles that clip in a weird way but look really cool when they're on. So I primarily stick within the cowl scarf genre, but I do make rugs and I make home goods, pillows, that kind of thing.
Megan Williams goes beyond yarn and weaving. She actually dyes the yarn to get the color she wants, and she's not using manufactured dyes.
My most recent experiment was doing the Pantone Color of the Year dye study that I do with my close friend Elise Welcher of Little Wings Designs. We've done this dye study for the past 5 years now, and we just look at the Pantone Color of the Year. This year it's Living Coral, and try to get that with natural dyes. We didn't quite get there with our first round of experiments, but we're already talking about doing our second. But the closest one was madder, and maybe madder over dyed with Kamala.
Why is natural dye important to you?
I just love the color that you can get from nature. I have a dye garden at Blandford Nature Center throughout the summer, and that's my favorite thing to do, is to like actually see the color grow. And especially when I can go on a hike in late summer and see goldenrod start to pop up, and just know that I can just boil up all those flowers to get a bright yellow, just really special.
This work is a way of expressing herself and her values. And William says it just feels good to be making fabrics and garments.
It's just the feeling of making something and making something new and creative and being in that state. It's when I'm most happy, is when I'm watching water boil and pulling out the white skein of yarn and turning into something completely different. And then from there, bringing it to the loom and being able to weave it. And then being able to go to a show, I do craft shows often, and to go to that show and talk to people and tell people that this is exactly how this thing came to be. I just really like that process.
What are the reactions?
I get a lot of people that can connect with what I do, that either their mother or grandmother wove to and had their own looms, or that they themselves sew, or they like to knit and crochet. Those are my favorite conversations to have with people, to be able to connect with them and to have them see that this is where this came from, and this is why it's valued at that point.
Williams says she does most of her work alone, but she does collaborate with some other creative people in Grand Rapids. She says she's inspired by them in many ways. I always like to ask the artisans I meet whether they're actually making a living with their craft. Almost all of them do, and some of them are doing quite well. Megan Williams says she's doing okay.
Yes, and I'm constantly seeing the growth. So I'm hoping that as the years go on, that I can find the bigger and better shows to go to that can support me more with this. I do work a part-time job that I really enjoy doing, so that I do like 2 days a week, but the other 3 to 4 days I'm working on Adventure Textiles.
I started this series almost 3 years ago because I had the idea that there were a lot of talented people working at a job they hate, or maybe just find boring. And I think there are a lot of people wondering how they might make a living doing what they love. So I asked Williams if she had any advice.
Just to start doing it, to start finding their feet and making the things that they want to make and finding their customer and doing different craft shows, even if it's a little local show in a gym, you know, bring a table, bring the things you make and see if people like it.
These days, she's doing some big shows, and people do like it. You can see examples of her work on our website, michiganradio.org. That's Megan Williams with Adventure Textiles, our latest artisan of Michigan. Support for arts and culture coverage is supported in part by an award from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Still to come, we'll look back at the Michigan connection to the domestic terrorist attack on a federal building in Oklahoma City in 1995.
They found where he had stayed the night before the bombing, and there he had used his real name and the farm as an address.
More after the break. You're listening to Stateside on Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. On this date in 1995, 168 people died and 700 were injured when a bomb put in place by Timothy McVeigh exploded in front of the Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City. A Michigan man was one of the co-conspirators in that domestic terrorist attack. Here to talk about that is Greg Staskel. He's a former FBI agent, and he wrote an article about the bombing for the website TickleTheWire.com. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I should say, welcome back to Stateside. You've been here before.
I have.
This Michigan man's name is Terry Nichols. What exactly was his connection to Timothy McVeigh?
Well, he and Timothy McVeigh met when they were in the Army together. Terry was, at the time of the bombing, was residing in Kansas, but he had previously resided in Michigan and grew up, and the family farm was up near Decker, Michigan.
You wrote that McVeigh and Nichols did some research on making a large bomb at Nichols' farm in Decker. What kind of research were they doing?
Well, the particular bomb that they made ultimately was what they call an AmFlow bomb, which is ammonium and fuel oil. What they did were experimenting with mixtures of the amount of ammonium to put in with the fuel oil. They experimented with that and also with some fusing and things like that.
So they were blowing up things out there by Decker?
Correct. Our evidence teams found pieces of shrapnel and trace amounts of the explosives and things like that.
Now, we talked about how many people were injured and died in the Oklahoma City bombing. How big was that bomb?
What they did was they actually got 55-gallon drums, and then they rented a truck in Junction City, Kansas. They had stored the ammonium nitrate and the fuel oil. They also had a certain amount of racing fuel, which is much more explosive than just regular fuel oil. So they mixed ammonium nitrate with the fuel oil in these 55-gallon drums and then loaded them on the back of a Ryder rental truck and ran fuses, duplicate fuses, to the cab of the truck. And that's the bomb that was driven to Oklahoma City on the 19th of April.
The big question is, why? Why did they blow up a federal building and kill all those people?
Well, Timothy McVeigh, after he left the service, and maybe while he was in the service, started to follow certain ideologies. And among them was white supremacy. There's a book called The Turner Diaries, which is sort of a white supremacist manifesto. Also sort of an anti-government, anti-Semitic. And he got into that. Who knows what else, but this sort of built up. And he was actually at the Davidian compound during the siege when, ATF had tried to do a raid there. The raid was unsuccessful, but then they had basically a barricaded gunman situation, and all the Davidians were in this compound and were there for 51 days. That siege ultimately ended on the 51st day, the 19th of April.
I want to talk about that date. Remember that date, April 19th. We'll talk about that later.
So the siege ended that day, but it ended with this fire that was actually determined. The fire was set by the Davidians themselves, and basically they had a suicide pact, and they decided they weren't going to give up. A good number of the people that died didn't die from flames. They died from self-inflicted gunshot wounds. Rather than surrender, they either committed suicide or allowed themselves to die in the fire.
Let's put a pin on that just for a second, because I want to talk about what happened to Nichols afterwards. A couple of days after Timothy McVeigh was apprehended, the FBI went to the Nichols farm in Santa Lac County. You were there, right?
That's correct. I was one of the SWAT team leaders.
What were they thinking that you guys might find?
Timothy McVeigh had listed the farm near Decker on the registration form at the motel where he stayed the night when he had loaded the bomb in the truck, spent the night at the motel, and then drove from Junction City, Kansas to Oklahoma City when he parked this rental truck next to the Murrah Federal Building. When the explosion went off, of course, the truck was destroyed, and it threw the axle a couple blocks away. But when they found the axle, they found the vehicle identification number, the VIN number on the axle, traced it back to the rental place in Junction City, Kansas, used a phony name and a phony address when he rented the truck. But they started doing what they call a neighborhood investigation, where they fanned out, found where he had stayed the night before the bombing. And there he had used his real name and the farm as an address. So that's what led us to the farm in Decker.
So you didn't know about Nichols at the time. You put it together after seeing this address.
I believe that's correct. At least we didn't, the SWAT team, when we secured the farm. And we had no idea who would be there. We didn't know if there would be additional co-conspirators, whether there was booby-trapped. There's all kinds of possibilities.
As it turned out, as you mentioned earlier, Terry Nichols had moved to Kansas, but his brother James was living at the farm. Did he have any idea what was going on?
You know, we were never able to prove he had anything going on. I mean, knew about the bombing or the conspiracy. But it's hard for, I think, anybody to believe, certainly the people that were involved in the investigation, that he didn't have some knowledge what was going on, in as much as they were building and testing bombs at the farm.
James died a couple of years ago. Terry Nichols is in a supermax prison near in Colorado. I read this online somewhere. I read that he shares a cell block that's commonly called Bomber's Row, where Ramzi Youssef, the guy who was part of the 1993 attack on the World Trade Center, is there. Eric Rudolph, the Olympic Park bomber, and Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber. That's quite a combination to have in one little cell block. We talked about April 19th for a second. Timothy McVeigh chose April 19th for a reason. First, what we were talking about with the Branch Davidians, there's another date that is involved here as well.
Yeah, and I'm not sure that he intended to do it on April 19th for any other reason other than that was the date that the end of the siege with the Branch Davidians in Waco, Texas. But as it turned out, and sort of, I guess, sort of a perverse twist of fate, that turns out to be April 19th being what they call Patriots Day, and it's of special interest in Boston, because on that date at Lexington Concord is when the Minutemen and the British faced off, and the famous shot heard round the world that started the American Revolution occurred on April 19th.
We also had a bombing right around there in Boston around the same time at the Boston Marathon a few years ago. Was that a coincidence or was that intentional too?
Well, it was intentional in the sense that the two brothers that bombed the Boston Marathon did it because they knew, of course, that there would be a crowd watching. But the Boston Marathon is always run on a Monday near the time of Patriots Day. It's like a lot of holidays. They celebrate it on a Monday to make an extended weekend. So that particular marathon, I believe, was run on the 13th of April. This year's Boston Marathon was on the 15th of April. That is the tie-in.
Well, you'd written this article several years ago that explains the history of April 19th, and then you kept bringing it back up to different publications because of all these ties, and the Boston Marathon was another example of why you needed to bring this story forward. Is the April 19th date going to continue to be something that, you know, the more radical militia might look to as a date to act?
I would suspect that would be the case. Interestingly, when Timothy McVeigh was arrested, he was wearing a T-shirt. On it, it had a quote from Samuel Adams. One of the men Paul Revere was trying to warn before the shot heard round the world, when the government fears the people, there is liberty. When the people fear the government, there is tyranny. Underneath, McVeigh had scrawled, maybe now there will be liberty.
Greg Stayskull's piece is titled The History of April 19th, American Revolution, Waco, and the Oklahoma Bombing. You can find it at ticklethewire.com, which covers federal law enforcement news. And it's also been published in this magazine for FBI agents. What's it called?
Well, it's the Society of Former FBI Agents magazine.
I'm not on their mailing list.
And it's called The Grapevine.
Well, thanks very much for coming in and telling us about this history.
You're welcome. Thank you.
The Chief Justice of the Michigan Supreme Court is calling pay for the court's justices a crisis. Their pay's been frozen since 2002, and if it keeps going the way it is, judges on a lower court, which get annual cost of living allowances, could soon make more than those on the high court. Here to discuss judicial pay and how Michigan goes about deciding who gets a raise are our political commentators. Ken Sikkema, Senior Policy Fellow at Public Sector Consultants and former Republican Majority Leader in the Michigan State Senate. Vicki Barnett is a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic member of the state legislature. So, Ken, the Supreme Court justices haven't got this raise, as I said, since 2002. No cost of living adjustment, nothing. And that means their salary has steadily fallen because of inflation. How'd that happen?
Well, Lester, I think every once in a while, the outcomes of some public policy decision made years ago become obviously absurd. And this is one situation and one example of that. And back in 2002, a constitutional amendment was adopted by the voters, put on by the legislature, I might add, put on the ballot, that required an affirmative vote of the legislature to approve salary increases for themselves and the Supreme Court and the governor and attorney general and secretary of state and lieutenant governor. And the legislature just has refused to approve any salary increases during that period of time.
But basically, they don't want to tell the voters, yep, I gave myself a pay increase or something like that, right?
Well, yeah, it's just sort of politically untenable. And I happen to believe what was done back in 2002, in retrospect, was a mistake. But yeah, the legislature is just reluctant to be on record approving salary increases, and the Supreme Court justices, their salaries become a casualty.
Hey, Vicki, I think a lot of folks would look at this salary. They're making more than $164,000 a year, and they'd be asking, what are they complaining about? But when you compare it to what a high-profile lawyer can make, that's not a lot. And when you compare it to the salaries of other states' Supreme Court justices, Michigan ranks 35th in the nation. So what do you make of this situation?
Problem, but it's a problem, as Ken pointed out, for all of our elected officials that serve that need to have their salaries approved by the legislature. And the problem is we've turned executive pay into a political problem. And no legislator wants to go on record saying, yes, I gave myself a pay increase. And at the same time, they've cut their pay by 10%. They've cut the executive offices by 10%, and they did that in 2010 in response to the economic crash. And then in 2016, they tied the lower court salaries to civil service pay increases and left the Supreme Court alone. So while the pay of lower court judges has been rising, the pay of our Supreme Court judges have not. And we've created a situation that needs an affirmative vote by the legislature, and the legislature decided 2 years ago that they weren't going to give the Supreme Court justices a 6% raise. And it's time that they did get one.
So what happens is the State Officers Compensation Commission makes a recommendation, and the legislature either says, yeah, or just dies. So what is being proposed now is maybe separating this out, one for the Supreme Court justices, one for the state officers, one for the legislators. How do you think the legislature might handle that, Ken?
Well, as you pointed out, the State Officers Compensation Commission is trying to figure out a way to give Supreme Court justices an increase, well-deserved, I might add, but recognizing that they would never be able to get the legislature to increase their own salary. So they're trying to separate the two issues, and they've asked the Attorney General for opinion. And I do think if they're allowed to do it constitutionally, then I think the Supreme Court justices probably get the raise adopted by the legislature, as long as the legislature doesn't have to raise their own pay.
Yeah, you mentioned the Attorney General. Paul Egan at the Free Press reports that the Attorney General's salary is like 36th in the nation, even worse than the Supreme Court justices. So, Vicki, what do you think? Do you think they can get away with separating this into three, and what would the legislature do?
I hope they can get away with separating it into three, and that gives the legislature cover for giving the Supreme Court justices the raise they so deserve. And I'm not sure that the executive branch doesn't deserve a raise as well. And I know that the legislative branch took a 10% pay cut. So it's unfortunate that all of this has become a political football since 2002, when the Officers' Compensation Fund would, prior to the ballot proposal, would propose a salary increase, and it was up to the legislature to affirmatively deny it instead of affirmatively accept it. So it's created this crisis. But then again, other people point out, well, we're not having any trouble finding people to run for these offices. So clearly, compensation isn't an issue. Otherwise, people would stop running. But I would argue that the legislature is getting younger and younger, and some of these people are right out of college or close to it, and are using this as a stepping stone to a higher paid position instead of using it as a professional position to cap off their public service. It's a conundrum.
I think the Chief Justice kind of made the same argument about getting people to run for the Supreme Court. It used to be like the pinnacle of a career, and now it's like, okay, well, this might be a step to a higher pay somewhere else. Is that actually happening, do you think?
Yes, it is happening. We've had several high-profile resignations of justices that have gone back into the private sector.
Yes, I was going to make the same point Vicki just made, that I do think we're in a situation today where, yes, people are leaving the Supreme Court to take more lucrative positions in the private sector, or just refusing to be nominated or consider running for the Supreme Court. So I think it's true that, well, you always get people to run for the legislature, you always get people to run for their governor. But I think it's a little different with the Michigan Supreme Court, given what's happened with their compensation. For the record, I do think this is an example of the downside, one of the downsides of constitutional amendments. Over time, in this case, it's not worked, but it's exceedingly difficult to change.
Vicki, you get the last word.
I agree with Ken, and we're going to have to come to grips with this situation sooner rather than later.
Hmm. Vicki Barnett is a former Democratic state legislator. Ken Sikkema is a former Republican-led state legislator. We need you guys back in office so you can actually fix some of these problems we keep talking about.
You mean the problems
so much,
we created?
Yeah, exactly.
I would so much have loved to serve with Ken Sikkema in the legislature with me. It would have been such a pleasure.
I was not going to bring up that this stuff happened when some of you were in the legislature, but now that Ken's spilled the beans. All right. Thanks, you two.
Okay. Bye. Have a happy Easter or Passover or whatever you celebrate, guys.
Thanks, Lester.
We like to hear from you, and we want to know what stories you're interested in, what issues you're wanting to hear more about. Just let us know. Send us an email to stateside@michiganradio.org. We're also on Twitter, @StatesideRadio, and we're at michiganradio.org. Just click the link that says Stateside. You can find me @MichiganWatch on Twitter. Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Mike Blank. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors today are April Van Buren, Sarah Leeson, Adam Reyes, and Joey Horan, who is spending his last day with us. We wish him all the best of luck. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.